morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sure you've been told this multiple times. Make sure all electronic devices are completely turned off. They should not be on vibrate. They should not be on silent. They need to be completely powered off. And we should be starting from the next few minutes. Stand, please.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. I represent the defendant appellant in this case, Alvaro Mejia. I've raised multiple issues, and I'll address them in order unless the court wants me to address one in particular. First, the reasonable doubt instruction. Mr. Mejia asked the district court not to give an instruction. This court in Taylor, then Judge Santel, said that when there's a choice between giving or not giving, the wisest position is not to give an instruction.
But the court expressly said that there was no error in giving this instruction, right?
No error in that case under its review of that case. But that case did not address two points that are raised by Mr. Mejia. And one is the evolving definition of firmly convinced. And there's multiple examples that we showed in the brief as to what the common understanding of firmly convinced today is. In fact, during the argument of the instruction before the district court, the judge inadvertently equated the term to serious concerns. I expressed to the court that I had serious concerns about the term firmly convinced because of its variable understanding, and the court came back and said, just like the term is just like serious concerns, it has those variable definitions. Nowadays, and further, the error was compounded because the court prohibited me from arguing that firmly convinced often in the vernacular has a lower meaning than is required by Winship and the Sixth Amendment. The other problem with the instruction, this is a specific intent crime, and it's a specific intent crime. This is a conspiracy to import cocaine into the United States. Trafficking in cocaine outside the United States is not a crime under the statute. Unlike most conspiracies, say a conspiracy in the United States, any involvement with cocaine would be violation of the law. You needed specific intent to import cocaine into the United States. And so the combination of that requirement, the scant evidence, and the failure of the entirety of the charge to expressly clarify that necessity for specific intent the inclusion of the natural and probable consequences, that whole combination of factors made this an instruction that lowered the burden for the government. The government has argued that the objection to natural and probable consequences was not adequately presented below. In fact, as soon as the judge finished charging the jury, counsel stood up to object.
Leave that aside for 1 second. The Sandstrom presumption was mandatory.
Correct.
Right? And in Franklin, the court says a permissive inference, talking about the same instruction, does not relieve the state of its burden of persuasion because it still requires the state to convince the jury that the suggested conclusion should be inferred based on the predicate facts proved. And this is a permissive in this case.
It is permissive, but I'm submitting to the court that the combination of all these errors.
So you don't think that independently this isn't an error, it's combined with the other two?
I believe independently it is because of the particular charge. Because of the particular violation of law, that is intent to distribute cocaine knowingly that it would be imported into the United States.
There was an instruction that they had to find that.
There was. But I would submit to the court it wasn't clear enough when you add on the natural and probable consequences. Because it's, as I said, it's easy to view a violation of the drug trafficking statutes as just a violation of law. That additional element of knowing or intending that the cocaine would come into the United States complicates the burden or complicates the...
But they were instructed that they had to find that.
They were.
And that was in it was also in the verdict sheet.
Yes. But again, the verdict sheet, going off on that issue and also on the sentencing, one of the primary sentencing arguments, the verdict sheet does not ask the jury to decide whether the defendant whether the defendant's liability for the conspiracy was reasonably foreseeable.
Actually, as long as we're on that one, it seems like the verdict sheet is even tougher for the government than that. The verdict sheet says you have to. The question is, with respect to the offense of conspiracy to import 5 kilograms into the United States, I'm just going to try and cut out part of it. Intending or knowing that such cocaine would be unlawfully imported into the United States, we the jury find the defendant guilty. So in a way, that seems even tougher on the government because it says not that it's good enough to be reasonably foreseeable, but rather you have to intend or know that 5 kilograms were going to be imported in the United States.
The problem, Your Honor, is there was ample evidence that there was a conspiracy.
But I just want to pause aside for 1 second, leave aside the evidence question. Isn't this verdict instruction better for you than a foreseeability instruction?
Well, this circuit and the Fourth Circuit in particular are really clear that what you need is reasonable foreseeability, those two terms.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is this doesn't even allow reasonable foreseeability. This says you have to intend or know. This is even better for the defendant.
Well, intend or know is the language in the statute. 21 U.S.C.
840. So, it's still better. If you had a choice between two instructions, instruction one, you cannot convict unless the defendant intended or knew that 5 kilograms were going to go into the United States, or an instruction that simply said you can't convict unless it was reasonably foreseeable that, reasonably foreseeable that 5 kilograms would be imported into the United States. Isn't the first one better for you?
Well, because the first one wouldn't be a violation of this statute. This statute requires intending and knowing that the cocaine would be imported into the United States.
Let me be clear. You have two choices. One is an instruction that says the defendant must intend or know that 5 kilograms were going to be imported to the United States. And the second is an instruction that says the defendant must reasonably foresee that 5 kilograms were going to be imported in the United States. Those are your two choices. Wouldn't you rather have the first?
It's a hypothetical that really doesn't.
Isn't that instruction a tougher one for the government and a better one for the defendant, that first instruction? Intend or no, isn't that better than simply reasonably foresee?
Yes, but what I'm telling the court is that in this statute, you would need intending and knowing. Otherwise, it's not a crime. And the problem with this instruction in a conspiracy case is that there could be a finding, and I won't dispute that, that there was a conspiracy based on the evidence. There were people that clearly, I mean, a co-defendant that was not tried with him because of the severance had multiple conversations with the informant. You know, Brooke came to the meeting with multiple things. So you could find a conspiracy. And the question is the defendant's involvement. My client attended three meetings. He was arrested at the third meeting immediately. At one meeting, he made two comments, which the government piled inference upon inference. But if you read what he said,
I understand, but this is now you're making a sufficiency of the evidence argument, not an argument about whether the instruction. But let me pause for a minute. You're not actually objecting to the instruction about foreseeability, are you? There's no place in a brief where you say there should have been a foreseeability.
No, that's the sentencing argument. That's the question of whether if there's no 5-kilogram finding, if there's no 5-kilogram reasonably foreseeable to the defendant, you can't impose a mandatory minimum. And the judge clearly said on the record that if he had a 0-20 case rather than a 10-40 case, he would be sentencing differently. He said that explicitly. I've gone into the sentencing issue. It's a combination of all the errors I would submit to the court in this case. The multiple misstatements by the government in closing argument, combined with the firmly convinced natural consequences, the introduction of hearsay by the pseudo expert, you know, the guy who says with no foundation whatsoever, I know, or there's no question that former police officers have contacts with people inside the police, when there's no evidence that my client reached out to anyone or even had any contacts of current people in this new agency called DEPA, which supposedly had been newly formed and was the people inside of it were vetted. The combination of all these, the chain of custody issue. They deliver a wallet. We have, and it's different because this is a foreign government. We don't know what their procedures are. There's no sort of, I see my time is up, if the court would allow me on this chain of custody issue. They get arrested by Guatemalan authorities. Sometime later, the government, there's a dispute as to how much time, but say 10 minutes later, the wallet is handed over to the DEA agent. He comes in. Not the wallet, three wallets with a bunch of other property. He comes in and says, this piece of paper, there's no verification of the handwriting, no date, nothing that links my client to this piece of paper with the names of DEA agents. He comes in and says, it came out of this wallet, this is where I found it. But we don't know what happened between the time they're arrested and the wallet is handed over.
But so the judge says, that's up to the jury, that is, you have the wallet. The wallet has your client's photo ID in it.
There's no question that they retrieved a wallet that belonged to my client. Okay.
And the only there is an argument that somebody took out the piece of paper and put it into that wallet. The judge says, well, you can make that argument to the jury, and the jury can decide. Is it an abuse of discretion to allow it under those circumstances?
But the cases that this court has decided has required a minimal showing of some chain of custody. This is really 10 minutes of not knowing. I concede that if it had only been his wallet, then the argument is a jury argument. But this is a case where they arrest three people, a foreign government arrests three people. We don't know what their procedures are. We don't know what happened. We don't know where this piece of paper come from. There's no evidence otherwise other than the agent. Oh, it's not listed on the return of property, you know, when they list what items were found. This piece of paper is not listed. This piece of paper, which the agent claims he recognizes the names on as DEA agents, it's not listed on the sheet of paper referring to my client.
Were you able to cross-examine about that?
Somewhat.
I mean, the point you just made was, were you able to make that point and point out that it wasn't on the list of property?
Yes. But as the court may know, evidentiary arguments and arguments and arguments to a jury, when you pile them on, after a while the jury closes off. This court and due process requires some minimal chain of custody when you're going to, and part of the problem was that the government argued, this is just some piece of, you know, it's one little incremental. And then on rebuttal, they make a big deal that this means, you know, this is the specific intent that it's coming to the U.S.
Yes, and they made a big deal in their briefs. In one part of the briefs, they say it's not important. In another part, they say it's big. So we have something to ask the government.
Yeah. And the misstatements in the rebuttal argument are particularly difficult because they're made in rebuttal. So I can't get up and say anything about it. And the argument about, you know, the preying on addiction and they make a lot of money, that's the government, the judge overrules my objection to that argument so that the jury is left with a feeling that not only is the argument something they should consider, but the judge has given its imprimatur when I object to say, you know, that's irrelevant to the facts of this case. So it's as I say, the evidence is, and I'm not making a sufficiency of the evidence argument, but the evidence is so slim. There are so many, I would suggest, major errors, but if you add all these minor errors, it comes to a point where it's just, I'm not making insufficiency of the evidence, but I believe due process was violated in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Aestreicher? Do you want to address Judge Garland's question first?
Will do. Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Stephen Aestreicher on behalf of the United States. Judge Garland made a point about the DEA list that was found in Mr. Mejia's wallet. We say that it was harmless error to admit that if it was error at all, and for the reasons we say in our brief, we don't think it was error.
You say it's harmless error. Yet on page 32, when you're discussing how great your evidence is, you say, the list itself was more damaging than any commentary about the Civil War could have been. It showed that Mejia was worried about anti-narcotics agencies, which in turn suggested he was participating in a drug deal, not aiding a shipment of Christmas ornaments.
It did do all of those things, and I do think it was important at the same time. It was a telling and significant piece of evidence that was cumulative to a number of other significant pieces. Sorry,
but still harmless.
But still harmless primarily because of the confession in this case. Mr. Mejia, on the flight back to the United States after being arrested in El Salvador, admitted that he knew Mr. Cortez had a plan to import cocaine into the United States, and that Mr. Mejia joined that agreement effectively by, posing as a high-level Guatemalan official, and he was asked to do that, and he did that in order to make money. So I think
pause over the question of whether allowing it in was error, regardless of the question whether it's harmless. Is it error to allow evidence in without a chain of custody?
I think under this court's decisions in Lane and Stewart, I think it's sort of like a McDonnell Douglas burden shifting type of framework, so that there's a presumption that the evidence is admissible on chain of custody grounds unless the defendant can come forward with some minimal showing of negligence or tampering. And I think that
how would they do that in a foreign country? How could they possibly have any way of making such a showing?
I'm not certain. I think that on cross-examination of Agent Fraga in this case,
Fraga doesn't know what happened during the 10 minutes. He just knows the bag was handed to him.
That's true. And I don't know that there's any way for anyone to be able to point out that, you know, what happened in those 10 minutes other than the Salvadoran police. So, you know, perhaps a Salvadoran police officer could have been called as a witness.
Then you would have had a chain of custody. Then we wouldn't have this problem.
I think that's right. I mean, I don't think there's a problem. I don't think, you know, again, if the defendant wished to do that might have met the minimal showing required.
Well, why didn't the government put on the officer to do that? That is typical, actually. You put on the person to testify, I did the search, I did the seizure, I handed it to X, or I put it in the plastic bag, I marked the bag, and this is the bag.
I guess, again, because of the, I'm assuming the prosecution knew of Lane and Stewart and thought that it would be presumed that the evidence would be admissible unless the defendant would show that it wouldn't be. And I would there were a couple other points I would like to respond to. The reasonable doubt instruction, this kind of Taylor was decided in 1993, and as Your Honor pointed out, it rejected the due process challenge in that case, which is, we think, the significant aspect of that case. We don't think that language has evolved so much in the last 16 or 17 years. And if you look in Webster's, collegiate dictionary, the word firm means unwavering, ensure. The word to convince means to persuade someone or to make someone believe in something to a certainty. So to the extent that Winship sets forward a certainty standard, I think the words firmly convinced meet that standard. So we think Taylor squarely governs here. There's no reasonable distinction between that case and this one.
Let me ask you about the gun. That to me was, I didn't understand why that went in. That is the gun permits. They didn't have guns on them, right?
That's correct.
And they had, what they took were...
They see in their wallets they found firearm permits. Those firearm permits, we suggested, no one was suggesting that Mr. Mejia or Mr. Morales or anybody other than Braun's driver had guns on them. What we were trying to suggest was that Mr. Mejia's primary defense was that he misunderstood all of this and thought it was about Christmas ornaments. And our response was to introduce evidence like this to say, well, clearly you're trying to, the presence of guns or firearm permits or some plan to possess a firearm.
I got the first words, the presence of guns, but then when he said, or firearm permits, he has a permit for a lawful permit.
And
he wasn't carrying a gun.
And he is a former
police officer.
That's correct. And there's no question that, of course, those were reasonable arguments for the jury. And I think, the sort of the value of this evidence is not particularly high, but the standard here is under Rule 403, which is whether the relevance of it is substantially outweighed by its prejudicial value. The relevance here was it at least showed it somewhat more likely than not that this was not about Christmas ornaments, that it was about something more dangerous or lucrative.
Why was it more likely? Why did it show that?
Well, I think as your honor pointed out in the McClendon case, guns and drugs tend to go together.
Usually we don't say permits and guns and drugs. Permits are illegal. He didn't have a gun, so...
But I don't think, in this case, on the facts of this case, again, that's obviously a strong point, up to the point that his role was going to be, protecting this cocaine, ensuring that it got all the way through Guatemala. That role hadn't yet come to fruition. What was going on, this was sort of the preparatory stages of it. He didn't need to bring guns to these meetings. He needed to, if at all, to bring them to whenever he was going to be securing the cocaine within Guatemala. And so, again, I don't think, and I think we're, it's sort of the theme of this whole appeal. I think Mr. Mejia kind of attacks, he sort of nibbles around the edges at very evidentiary pieces. The main evidence in this case was the videotapes showing Mr. Mejia sitting at these meetings talking about a drug deal. And what he knew was a drug deal given his statement about DEPA, that clearly shows. And in fact, he volunteered that information about DEPA, by the way, before Mr. Cortez even started talking about his plan. So clearly Mr. Mejia was clued in before the meeting. So that's, fact number one. Fact number two was the confession on the plane. Mr. Mejia doesn't challenge the admissibility of that on appeal. I think the most he says about it is in his reply brief. He says, well, my plan was something different what their plan was. I was sort of thinking about stealing the cocaine. Well, that's an acknowledgement that we're talking about cocaine and not Christmas ornaments.
Let me ask you about the gun permit again. Let's say a policeman stops someone on the street who is staggering drunk and headed for his car, and he has a driver's license, and he charges him with drunk driving. He's not in the car. This man doesn't have a gun.
I think that evidence is a little more tenuous as to the drunk driving charge than a firearm permit would be as to potential future use of a firearm to protect cocaine. And I think it probably would be more prejudicial in that case, too, because you would be suggesting that, he was obviously going to go driving, but he was just walking around. I think those are generally matters for the district court to make and, determinations for the district court to make in the first instance. Under Rule 403, this court has said repeatedly, the district court gets broad discretion in this area. It makes an on-the-spot call that this court doesn't quite get from the cold record. And the main thing...
Your better argument here that this is an incredibly weak and perhaps stupid thing for the government to put into evidence, but on the other hand, for the same reason, it's so incredibly weak that it couldn't really be harmful.
I think that's probably a fair statement. I would say that, and Your Honor was talking about the DEA list. I think the DEA list is more probative evidence than the firearm permits were. But the main point here is under the commentary to Rule 403 says, you know, what you're concerned about in the 403 context is the jury coming back with a conviction for an improper reason, an emotional reason. I don't think you have the jury doing that in this case. I mean, there's a core of evidence in this case that's not challenged. There was never any suggestion from the government that Mr. Mejia was a violent man or that you should convict him because he's dangerous and he's preparing to, that the DEA list was some kind of hit list or something. There's just no suggestion about any of that. And there was one final point I'd just like to make quickly about the inferred intent instruction. I think you don't need to resolve the issue of whether it's plain error. We still stand by our argument that you should review it for plain error because I believe even though Mr. Mejia was not given a chance, basically the district court read its instructions and then, you know, sort of left the jury to retire, and Mr. Mejia didn't really get a chance to object at that point. But he had a chance, as I understand it, throughout the trial. The district court gave its proposed instructions to the parties, and Mr. Mejia certainly felt free, his counsel certainly felt free as the proceedings went on to object to various instructions.
Is there any, you're talking about the...
The Sandstrom issue.
Is there any case that's ever held that I'm wondering why you're worried about this. Is there any case in which a court has said that a completely permissive instruction, which is what this is not okay?
But not that I know of, Your Honor.
Justice Brennan, who wrote both Sandstrom and Franklin, said in Franklin that Sandstrom doesn't apply to permissive instruction. The problem in Franklin was that there was a shifting set of there was a prima facie and a rebuttal.
Precisely. And I would agree with Your Honor, and we cite several cases in our footnote 7, I believe it is. And so we aren't that concerned about it. I just wanted to respond to that point.
How about this reasonable foreseeability where, where under Graham, which you cite, as long as it's within the or below the statutory maximum, you don't have to ask the jury, at least in our circuit, how much is he responsible for, or how much was reasonably foreseeable?
I think that's right. I mean, I think the point that Judge Garland was making earlier was that this instruction wasn't objected to, that this is purely a sentencing issue, and I think that's right. I mean, I profess really not to understand the Apprendi argument because the indictment charged 5 kilograms. The instruction required, it was one of the elements of the offense was to find that this conspiracy involved 5 kilograms or more, that was the scope of the agreement. And if the evidence shows that Mr. Mejia agreed and joined into this conspiracy, I don't see how there can be an Apprendi problem. And certainly there was no Apprendi Booker style problem at sentencing by the judges engaging in preponderance of the evidence fact finding either. And that's, we think, clear under Settles as well. And I see that my time is up. But.
Before you sit down, I do want to ask you, Mr. A. Stryker, all this talk about Christmas ornaments, and this question comes from someone whose probably most prized possessions are her Christmas ornaments. You're not saying that they're not worth protecting, are
you? Oh, of course not. Of course not. But we think it's quite clear that his defense was that he was protecting Christmas ornaments, and we think that's obviously not the case based on the evidence.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Does Ms. Hernandez have any time? All right, why don't you take 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, his defense was that he did not have the intent to enter into conspiracy to import cocaine into the United States. He sat there, it was a scam. He purported to be the head of customs when he wasn't the head of customs. No evidence that he knows anyone in customs. No evidence that he reached out to anyone in customs.
Say about the confession.
It's not a confession. The statement that he made was that and he's the last one to be interviewed for less than 30 minutes. The others are interviewed for hours. He's the last one to be interviewed. He's not stupid. I mean, now he's on a DEA. Now he's on a plane. He's been told that this is DEA. What he says is, yeah, there's coke. They talked, or the deal was about cocaine. My intent, this is the government statement. My intent is to steal the cocaine and sell it in Guatemala. That's the quote unquote confession.
No Christmas ornaments.
No. And there was no defense of Christmas ornaments. The defense was intent. The defense is that they had one meeting where he made a comment, and I cite the three lines that he makes about DEPA. And DEPA is an agency by the government's testimony that is a customs agency.
So his defense was He knew that they were planning to import it into the United States, but he was going to steal it from them and sell it in Guatemala instead?
No, his defense is, I did not conspire to import cocaine into the United States.
I was getting paid to... I intended to steal it and sell it in Guatemala.
If it came to cocaine, I intend... That's what he tells...
What's the if it came to cocaine part? I thought that he conceded that it was cocaine.
There's a statement that is... There's no document that says this is my statement.
So you're challenging the statement. It's not...
Well, what I'm saying is it is a paraphrase by two agents who don't speak Spanish. There's no... One agent spoke Spanish, but the agent who testifies about the confession doesn't speak Spanish. So he's reporting what... The other agent, who's not an interpreter, there's no signed statement. He says he said something about cocaine.
This argument, was this made in front of the jury, this kind of argument that you're making now?
Yes.
So you challenge the reliability of the statement?
There was a lot as to that, and it was about a reasonable doubt. Do you have a reasonable doubt that, in fact, he said what he said? But even if you accept what he said... It's not a confession that I intended to import cocaine. This is a scam, Your Honor. There's no evidence that my client did anything in furtherance of the conspiracy in terms of, other than show up at this meeting, some other guy gets $10,000, which one could infer was divided among four people. He wasn't present. The conspiracy starts with another defendant who supposedly dies in a car accident. It's taken over by this other guy, Brandt. My client's not at the first meeting where there's all these details of the importation thing. At the meeting he attends, at the second meeting where he says nothing, they talk about Christmas ornaments and a corporation, and this other guy brings in these corporate documents. At the meeting he's at, the word cocaine is never uttered. And what he says about DEPA, which, as I said, is an agency, newly formed customs agency, for three purposes: contraband, narcotics, and something, graft, I think. He says there are going to be some new changes. They're going to create a new unit, DEPA, over in Guatemala, DEPA. There's a lot of unintelligible. We don't know what preceded, what brought him to say that. He makes a statement about DEPA before they start talking about a cocaine transaction.
It's... Got your question.
I'm sorry.
All right, you've gone over your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You were appointed to represent Mr. Mejia, and we thank you for your help.
Thank you, judges.